Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, and thanks to Ian Daybourne for the last 2 hours. And you're listening to Flavour, the food and drink programme for Cambridge. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. Today's programme includes what's good in wine at the moment, the new events at May's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. We go shopping at Culinaris in Mill Road, eating at Me and I in Castle Hill, and Romano's Kitchen at Burwash Manor, and cocktail sipping with Aoife Maxwell. And we've the city and the university food and drink news too. Gigi Perry from Pembroke College will be along with that later.
First up, though, for those whose interest in food extends beyond the eating of it, there are some interesting seminars called Food from Field to Table? And it's at Cambridge University. Alan spoke with conveners Claire Agius and Luke Bradshaw and asked if that title really needed the question mark. I mean, isn't that what happens? It goes from the field to the table? But it isn't, as Claire explained.
The reality is quite far from that. So, for example, we have technologies that are allowing food to be grown away from the field. We have multinational companies that operate supply chains across many different countries. We have trade subsidies that influence what farmers grow. And then we have all sorts of marketing techniques that companies use to influence what consumers buy.
Right, so these series of seminars discuss those areas. But when you say food isn't just grown in small fields and delivered to our table, are you talking about things like polytunnels and that sort of thing, or is there something more than that?
An example is lab meat. So the idea of lab meat is researchers have shown that they can take cells from a particular tissue type, so say muscle cells, and grow those in lab conditions to produce a particular type of meat. So in the future, you might be eating burgers that are made entirely out of lab-raised meat.
Right, so just, what we'd all call test tube meat.
Yes, exactly.
How far away is this?
But they're certainly making it at the moment, but it's very expensive to purchase.
Right. How expensive, Luke?
So currently I think the estimate is £2,000 to £2,500 per steak, which probably, isn't going to be coming off the shelves anytime soon.
Right, but people are working on it and the cost will come down as it does.
The costs are expected to come down, and because you're controlling the energy going in a lot more easily than a cow in a field, it should eventually work out cheaper if the technology works out, because you just have your steak growing up on a plate. Just add some sugar and then it will grow up.
Oh, wow. Right. And who is doing this? Is it so universities doing it? Big food corporations?
A university research group in the Netherlands is the pioneers. And basically, 2 years ago, their professor publicly ate one of his own lab meat burgers, which was the first time anyone had done this. And he didn't die, thankfully. he said it wasn't chewy enough. So they're working on how to make it textured a bit more like real meat.
Yeah.
We mentioned about lab meat, but also a big growth area is looking at whether we can use insects as food. So we had an insect tasting buffet, and we had some ants, we had some grubs. We thought probably you needed to cook them nicely in a sauce before they're too edible. I think just the dried salted insects isn't the way to go, was what we learned.
What were they like?
Some of them were quite tasty. There were some paper wasps which had a kind of lemony flavour to them, which was quite interesting. And one of the fatter grubs was more just like chicken. But a lot of the intermediate-sized things were quite crunchy. And for us, we don't really like having that crunchy feeling in your mouth. So they definitely need to be processed in some way.
Yeah. When you say one of the fatter grubs, one of these sort of white...
Yeah, so something about the size of your finger that you can bite into and eat.
And it tasted like chicken.
Yeah. I think the big ones are easier because it's more like a real meat. It's the small, chewy ones that we need to work on.
But in places like Thailand, for example, don't they eat, is it locusts?
Yeah. So it's Actually, Europe is the strange place. So most cultures have a history of eating food, insects in one form or another as food. Europe is kind of uniquely averse to eating insects. But yeah, in North America, in Africa, in Asia, there's all been different insect food sources through history.
Mm-hmm. One of the seminars has been about, well, it was called Big Ships, Big Data, Horse Meat. So let's stay on the meat end of things at the moment. What was that one about?
Yes, so this seminar was basically looking at how all the food we buy in the supermarket gets there. And it's often, if you look at your peppers in the supermarket, you see they're grown in Spain or Chile or New Zealand. And basically, you have these enormous container ships which move food across the world. And to do that, you need a lot of information. And then also, you need people to check it is what it says it is. So when a container turns up, is what's in this container what it's meant to be? And the big example of that going wrong was the horse meat scandal in 2013. So we found that some burgers had some horse meat in them. And so basically we had a law professor who was talking about whether EU laws made it harder for us to pick up that horse meat. So there's this law called the free movement of goods that means that you have to think something is wrong with a shipment before you can inspect it if it comes from an EU country.
So there aren't automatic checks that the meat is...
So there aren't automatic checks, and you'll probably be interested to hear that since the horse meat scandal, the number of checks is actually down 25%, so we're probably less likely to be picking up the next horse meat scandal currently.
And on the 24th of February, there's a seminar on politics of food provisioning and access. What's that about?
So when you have subsidies for farmers to grow certain crops, obviously you influence them, so they're more likely to go crops that you get a lot of money for. So we see what's called the EU Common Agricultural Policy, which affects farmers in the UK. And for example, after the floods, there was a lot of debate because they're not given money to keep forest. And one of the ideas people had was that if you had more forest around watercourses, you wouldn't get as much flooding. So it's stuff like that, looking at how government funding can influence what food is grown.
The talk seemed quite political, Claire. Is it? Are they the same sort of topics each term?
No, we try to have quite a broad range of topics. So we initially started off looking at the production of food. So, for instance, how can we achieve more yield of certain crops? How can we use technology to increase the nutrition of foods that we grow? This term we're focusing on the market influences on the food system. So, for example, agricultural subsidies, the right to food, issues like that. And next term we'll focus on consumer choices. We'll look at whether consumers actually have a choice as to what food they purchase. Or is it more that the retailers have quite an influence on what consumers actually end up purchasing?
So what, will you be sort of looking at things like the impact of advertising and
certainly
packaging perhaps?
Yeah, so yeah. Food labelling, food safety, ethical consumerism, so certification programs such as Fair Trade and organic certification. Are consumers actually influencing the food system in a positive way, or are those having unfortunate byproducts? We'll also look at food waste, which is of course a big issue in both developed and developing countries. In developed countries, it's the supermarkets that waste a lot of food, but also consumers. So we'll look at what sort of factors influence the production of that waste.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you say that in developing countries there's a lot of food waste. Is that deliberate food waste as it is here, or is it?
No, it's quite different. So there the food waste is actually an issue with the supply chain. So for instance, they might not have refrigerated transport. So the food waste tends to be from the farm to the retailer, whereas in countries such as the UK, it's more from the retailer to the consumer.
Mm, yeah, OK. You're planning on doing some public events in the future, Luke. How can people find out?
We're going to have a debate on diet, and you'll be able to find details as they come out at CAMFSF. So that's at CAMFSF.
Claire Agius and Luke Bradshaw there. You can find out about the sessions by going to the CRASH website. That's CRASH with a double S in the middle. It stands for Creativity in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. Details on the debate about diet will be found, as Luke said, from at CAMFSF. It stands for Food Security Forum. And it made me wonder, Ruth, have you eaten any insects and bugs in your life?
Not unless you count the green flies I've swallowed when I'm on my bike.
No, that doesn't count.
No.
Well, Dojo, the noodle bar on Mill Lane, closed back in 2014, and its customers have since hoped for a return, and that time has come. Me and I, M-E-E, 2 months ago, opened on Castle Street. It includes Dojo's former head chef and staff. Flavour's roving contributor Pina Broccoli and I popped into Me and I for lunch and a chat.
I'm at Me and I with Sunny, the manager. So how long has Me and I been open?
We opened before Christmas, roughly about 2 months.
I believe there's a connection to the old dojo that was very much loved among people of Cambridge.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we got a lot of chefs from Dojo, and they're cooking very nice food.
And are they making some of the same menu items from Dojo, or is it different?
It's slightly different, but they're cooking the same noodles and using the same chef, everything the same. But we add something new to the new restaurant.
So I noticed that the menu is a mixture of different types of cuisine from different countries.
We do Asian foods, and we're also doing Japanese, Korean, Chinese.
The menu is really nice. Just had lunch, and I had a bunch of little sharing plates.
Yeah, we do.
It was very nice.
We did a starter, but I like the bao. It's very nice.
That's the steamed bun.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, steamed things. We've got chicken, fish, different flavour of pork. It's nice bao, and also the customer saying this bao is the best thing they had. Any other restaurant, they don't do this, so quite recommend people to having this.
Yeah.
And it's a starter for two people to share. It's nice.
You have a bunch of little tapas or sharing plates.
Yeah, we do a lot of seafood and meat things and vegetarian. Also, we vegetarian and gluten-free menu is coming out in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, that's really good. That's good. I had a huge bowl of satay noodles, a plate of satay noodles,
which was
taking half of it home now.
Yeah.
It was delicious. Can you tell us a bit about some of your noodle dishes?
Yeah, noodle dish, we do a lot of different flavor. We do pad thai, we do udon, soba. It's all Asian noodles we're doing right here.
And some of the soups as well?
Yeah, the soups as well.
Ramen,
yeah.
A lot of people
like
popular.
Ramen, yes, I know. And lasa is a Malaysian soup. And tom yum, because the chef stayed in Malaysia for 15, 20 years, so they're cooking lasa and tom yum. It's perfect.
What's in the tom yum? Does it have meat in it?
Yeah, you got different choice. You got seafood, or you can have a beef, or you can have a chicken. It's all different tastes.
And then some of the noodles, spices as well that you can...
Yeah, we're doing a very, very spicy noodles in our shop.
Is that the angry me?
Yeah, the name just scare people. We call it angry me.
My husband had that, and he's a spice fiend, and it was very good for him.
I know, but I like the spicy food. I can take it. It's very nice for me. For people who like spicy food, it's perfect, this one.
I did notice that you adjusted the spice for some of the other customers.
Because some of the customers, just they thinking they can take it, but they're not. And sometimes I remind them to having it with less spicy is perfect.
I had the satay mee with a combination of chicken, char siu, pork, beef.
Yeah, it's called satay mee cham cham. It's like a mix of meat and vegetables, satay noodles.
And it had a bit of spice to it too, but for me it was perfect. And it was nice, you took the duck out for me. So there's a bit of everything.
Yeah.
Whether you just want to come and just have a couple of drinks and share little plates, or have like a big bowl of soup or noodles.
Because we got a very big restaurant. We got like upstairs, we can run the party for 100 people.
It's really nice up here. It's a big
space for them.
Actually, a really good location too, because it's still central enough, but a bit farther up on Castle Hill.
But we're near the college, near the University of Cambridge.
And you've got the council across the street. Mm. So are you open 7 days a week, or what are your hours?
Yes, we open 7 days a week right now, 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock, Monday to Friday, and Saturday and Sunday we open all day.
Till what time?
10:30.
Okay, so you come here for a nice evening meal on a Saturday
night.
Right. Sounds nice, very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for speaking with me, Sunny.
I'll let you
get back. There's a crowd of people coming in.
Thanks again.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Me and I are located at 45 to 47 Castle Street. You can find their menu online at meandi.co.uk. That's me with two E's. And if you'd like to read more about Pina's visit, just point to your browser to her blog at 12culinarystew.com.
Broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
On our last programme, we had an interview with Heidi White, the director of Eat Cambridge, and she told us of some of the events coming up in this year's Food and Drink Festival. But I spoke with her again this week to find out about some more. Heidi, I understand there's a few new events at Eat Cambridge this year, things that you've never done before. Could you give us an idea as to what sort of things they'll be?
Yeah, of course. We've got some really exciting events this year, actually, which we think will complement really nicely the old favourites, you know, that we have coming up every year. We've got a big new event at Burwash Manor out in Barton, which they're putting on for the first time, which is an al fresco pop-up restaurant that will take place in their courtyard. It will mainly feature the new cafe owner, Paola's Food, Romano's Kitchen, as well as wines from the wine merchants that they've got on site there. So if you picture an outdoor feast under the stars, festoon lights, I think it will be really exciting.
Because you've done events there as well, haven't you? And it's worked well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a really, really good space. People don't know it so well. Sometimes they're a bit surprised to find it is a really beautiful layout there. It's surrounded, obviously, by the beautiful farmland. Mm. And for an evening, it can really be transformed. Yeah. So, yeah, it will be really nice.
Yeah, and there's a car park.
Of course, there is, yeah.
What more could you want? I think last time we talked quite a lot about food. Anything on drinks?
Yeah, people do mention, actually, that there's not so much on drink. But there is, if you look hard enough. But this year, there'll be quite a big drink-themed event. So hopefully that will tick a lot of boxes for wine lovers. We're having a wine festival running alongside the festival, which will be hosted by Cambridge Wine Merchants. It will be an entire weekend event in quite a large, interesting venue in the city centre. And we'll feature wine stalls where you can have samples and tasters, as well as tutored wine tastings and workshops going on, and food as well to nibble and soak up the alcohol.
Good.
Yeah, it isn't the first time Cambridge Wine Merchants have done a wine fair or festival, but it's the first time I think that it will run for a whole weekend, and also it will be tying in with Eat Cambridge, so hopefully people will go along to lots of food events as well as that. So yeah, it should be a great weekend.
Right, good. Anything else? Gin is always popular. Have you got anything on gin?
We have, funnily enough, the beautiful venue of Childerly, the Long Barn out at Childerly Hall, be hosting a live performance of the Gin Chronicles in their really, really beautiful grounds.
Right, now, I'm not sure what the Gin Chronicles are, so I won't ask.
I think we'll have to find out. From what the organiser, Joss, was saying, it will be quite an interesting story that unfolds with lots of comedy escapades along the way. And they'll be hosting gin activities alongside. So, you know, think tastings and gin games. I think it'll be really fun.
Oh, yes, it sounds very good. And is this a day or an evening?
It's an evening. Yeah, it's an evening event. I believe a Thursday evening. But
right.
You'll have to look out
check
when
the program
comes out. Yeah. We've got another al fresco event, so I think people are hoping for very good weather this May. The Botanic Garden Cafe is hosting a tapas pop-up, actually on the terrace of the cafe within the Botanic Gardens. That's another evening event with some beautiful tapas dishes, sherry, wine, that kind of thing. And then you can take a stroll around the garden at dusk as well.
So, that sounds nice.
Yeah, that should be nice. That's a new one for us to be involved with. There's also a couple of more hands-on interactive workshops / suppers that are going on. One of them is a sushi-making workshop at Bridges Cafe, which we haven't had before. And the other is a supper club on a rooftop. I think that's all I can say about the venue for now, which features people printing their own food using a 3D food printer. And then every evening the supper club runs, different food will be created depending on different people's tastes and experiences. So every experience will be different.
That sounds extraordinary.
Yeah, it sounds a bit out there, but really fun.
Right, well, that's a new experience.
I just wanted to mention as well, we have got a bit of a focus on chef demos. So following on from the interactive type events, people do seem to love that, and they like to watch chefs at work.
It is really interesting, isn't it? Any number of television programmes on it.
Well, exactly, yeah. Every weekend people are glued to those kind of shows. Yeah. So we've got a chef demo from Mark Poynton at Alimentum, which is quite an intimate demo in the restaurant, followed by a five-course bespoke tasting lunch on a Sunday. So he'll talk through two really signature dishes about how he uses his seasonal local food, and then he'll show how to plate and how that affects the diner's experience. Mm. And then you'll all enjoy five courses of his lovely food as well.
Wow.
And there'll be wine to match if desired. We really want to do more of that kind of thing, so I do think that will be a popular one, and hopefully in future years we can add more of that chef demo element, like the big food festivals do.
It is really interesting, and it's great, you know, that you're sort of always thinking about how to, you know, improve what's already a really good festival.
Yeah, well, thank you. We'd like to expand further, keeping it local and focused on independence, definitely. And we don't need any of the big celebs as such. But yeah, people do love to come along, see some demos, taste some food, and we want to give that full experience.
Oh, that sounds tremendous. Right, I know you told me last time, but I've forgotten. When's the programme likely to be out?
The programme, you can check on the website for the online version the end of March, and then you'll be able to get your hands on a proper copy first week of April onwards.
Right, well, we'll look forward to that.
Good.
Thank you very much. That was Heidi White from Eat Cambridge, which runs this year from the 7th to the 22nd of May. And the main event is on the 7th of May at the Corn Exchange. And I must say, it's beginning to sound like this year's festival is shaping up to be the best yet. Printed food.
Now, there's been an exciting new addition to Burwash Manor with the opening of Romano's Kitchen, who recently took over the tea room on their site. Flavour contributor Pina Broccoli Anaya found out more about their all-day breakfast menu, specials and future plans, and they all feature that special touch of owner Paola Davis Romano.
I have the pleasure of speaking to Paola Davis Romano and her daughter Ariane of Romano's Kitchen. So you've recently taken over the cafe at Burwash Manor, very exciting.
We've just been open now for about a week and a half. So we thought we'd start the first week as a celebration week for the humble British breakfast.
You've got the Burwash breakfast in one, and then you have a vegetarian version. So what's
Well, with the Burwash breakfast in one, that's for people that like meat and lots of protein. So on that one, you'll find some lovely smoked, grilled bacon that's locally sourced, sausages locally sourced, free-range eggs. You can either have a choice of scrambled eggs or fried eggs. Roasted baby vine tomatoes drizzled with pesto oil.
Oh, I love that. Thank That's like a bit much. Unexpected.
And a bit of a touch. Actually makes a big difference
the
to
pesto,
the breakfast,
yeah.
Actually. It does. Chestnut mushrooms, which we bake with a little bit of parsley, a little bit of garlic.
But there's a little bit of a sauce on it?
Yeah, use a bouillon.
Oh, that's what it is.
So
it's very tasty.
Our little touch, just so it's not just a plain mushroom. So, you know, there are various little touches in there. And then obviously you've got the lovely Tuscan-style beans. And all of this is served with sourdough toast with a choice of either marmalade, honey, jam and Marmite. So it's a complete breakfast. So if you come down hungry and you won't go away disappointed. And then the vegetarian one, we have free-range eggs, scrambled or fried, roasted baby vine tomatoes, chestnut mushrooms, the lovely Tuscan style beans, but you also get crispy potatoes that we bake as well every day with rosemary and a little bit of garlic of thing, which people like. Again, served with toasted sourdough, which is made for us by Helen from White Cottage Bakery.
She's relatively local.
She's in Kingston, and she's just been absolutely amazing. She's been supporting us all the way through, and it's fantastic. There's a choice of all sorts of things. We had a gentleman came in the other day, and he wanted some granola at 3 o'clock. So our granola is homemade on site, and that's served with Greek yogurt and seasonal fruit compote, which again we make on site. So
you don't necessarily have to have like a big, huge thing.
No. There's a choice of things you can have there. You know, one thing that's proven very, very popular is streaky bacon, avocado, lemon mayonnaise topped with sourdough toast. And that's really popular.
That really
People
good.
Love that.
And you've got things with hollandaise sauce as well.
Absolutely.
Benedict.
Yeah, we've got smoked almond Benedict and smoked salmon royale, which we serve with Chapel and Swan smoked salmon. So, you know, there's a lot of continuity on site.
Yeah,
so if you like what you eat, you can go and buy it from the larder so you don't have far to go. So, yeah, they're very pleased with it.
And do you have like smaller portions for kids? Or
we
a
do.
Kids menu? Or?
We've developed a little person's menu because we think we're really, really keen on giving children the opportunity to have the same food as their
yeah,
parents.
Yeah, it's true. Do kids like it?
Kids absolutely love it. We had a lady come in the other day and she had a nice bit of French toast and then her son had exactly the same, just a smaller portion, yeah.
And she said, I've never seen him this quiet. So that's positive. That's really positive.
Because it's a small place.
he thoroughly enjoyed it. And then he said that it was like a cinnamon donut.
It is. Well, it's very
with
good.
A good bread.
But it has nice seasonal fruit on it.
It does. Yeah, absolutely.
Really nice.
We make the compote, you know, with what's in season at the moment. And it just, you know, very popular at the moment, so.
And you've got a nice selection of hot drinks. Yeah. You've got, you know.
Yeah, we're using our coffees. People are loving the coffee. It's supplied by Hot Numbers. We've had the pleasure of having Simon coming in and training us to make the coffee properly.
That's excellent.
So that's good news. That's positive.
It's really good cooperation.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So as you can see, it's all local and we're all working together.
And you've got hot chocolate as well, cream and marshmallows.
Yes,
oh dear!
We start to get a reputation for hot chocolates. Yeah. They are huge to say the least. But you know why not? There's no point in having a half-hearted hot chocolate. You might as well have it the full hog with loads of squirt cream, loads of marshmallows.
If you want, yeah.
Chocolate sprinkles.
Yeah. Fantastic.
All very, very good.
So you do have Italian-inspired things on your menu, like puccia cob, which I'm Italian, but I never heard of. What is a puccia cob?
The puccia cob is like a lovely, wide, flattish Pugliese roll from the Puglia region. And I've been working with Helen from White Cottage Bakery for the last several months on getting it right. And she's been absolutely amazing with accommodating our need. And they're quite exclusive to Burwash. And they're a just lovely sourdough roll with either sausage, smoked bacon, or we have this Italian recipe, which I was brought out on, which is a stracciatella and cheese.
I know
and
it
spinach.
Is a soup, stracciatella
It is in Italy, it is a soup, but this is not a soup. It's like broken eggs with fresh spinach and cheese in the roll.
Do you find that people are adapting well, thinking, well, it's not just your average tea room with toasties,
so.
And it's a bit of a more imaginative menu?
Yeah, we're trying to promote local produce. So we're using Chapel and Swan for our smoked salmon, and we're using White Cottage Bakery and Dovecot Bakery. They're all local. And as far as possible,
I think your cakes as well are from...
Cakes are local as well.
People.
Some we make.
Yeah.
Some come from Gourmandise.
Yeah.
Corinne from Gourmandise. Yeah. And then we have Gourmet Brownie Company, which have just started stocking their gourmet brownies in Harrods.
The good
as well.
Stuff.
Yeah,
oh, really?
So, yeah.
That's great.
They've only literally just started. So we're actually quite honoured to have all of these lovely
Cambridgeshire
people working.
People.
All
yeah.
Cambridgeshire people, absolutely.
And you're a Cambridgeshire person as well.
Exactly.
You've
I've been
living here.
A local producer for the last 4 years. Yeah, so the breakfast's going very, very well. I think the one thing that people are quite enjoying is a pain perdu, which is made with a lovely pain de mie, again, made by White Cottage Bakery.
That was amazing.
Thank you very much.
And cinnamon French toast.
Yeah. I think there are a couple of places that do it, but...
I haven't seen it at all.
No,
so
there you are, so that's quite good. Yeah. Breakfast has been very, very popular, all-day breakfast, so we're going to stick to that, and we're introducing some lovely specials. We're going to be having things like croque monsieur and a Romano's Welsh rarebit with black bomber and leek and that sort of thing, so... come in and visit us and they'll be on the blackboard soon. So.
And you'll always have a soup of the day. So
always. The soup of the day was always very popular before Christmas, and we make literally fresh soups every day, chunky soups, and that's served with a lovely artisan bread. People love it. Today at the minute we've got a ratatouille and butter bean, tomato cream.
So nice hearty
soup.
Soups, but I think it's probably seasonal as well.
Yeah, it is. We're using what we've got, what we can get in season as far as possible.
And you've got big portions too. Like your Burwash breakfast in one is becoming legendary.
Yeah, I wouldn't want the
whole meal of the day.
I wouldn't want people to go away thinking, oh, I'm still hungry. You know, my family, I was brought up in an environment where food is very important. Being brought up in an Italian family, food is really important meal of the day.
Mangia, mangia.
Mangia, mangia. That's the time that you sit at the table and spend time with the family. Sit down and eat around the table. In Italy, you know, our lunch times could take up to 3 hours. A bit of vino on the table, and that's it. And then you have a sleep. So, you know, it's really important for us to people to come in. And this is where, what we're aspiring to be. Have good homemade food. Nothing too fussy. It's English food. It's Spanish. It's Italian. It's French. is from all over. Come in, have some hot food, have a cake, whatever, and then you can pop into the larder after and maybe take some of our food away.
Yeah, you're very known for very well known for doing these great bakes. So what kind of lasagna?
We have. The larder sell the moussaka, which is very very popular. The lasagna alla romano, which is popular.
Yeah.
We do lovely vegetarian. We have probably stock quite a huge selection of vegetarian food that we make as well. So you know, the idea is that you can come in and eat it hot, and then pop into the larder and take it home. All the foods can be frozen because they're all freshly cooked. So there's a lot there. It's not just come in and eat it. You can actually take away.
Well, it was fantastic speaking to you both.
Thank you very much. It was
a lot of fun
talking to you.
Thank you for coming and doing the interview.
Thank you.
You can find Romano's Kitchen on Facebook. They're also on Instagram and Twitter at Baked by Romano's. And their website is burwashmanor.com.
Thank you very much.
One additional thing to note is that the larder at Burwash Food Hall will host its annual Love Food Festival on the 13th and 14th of February between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. It will take place in the Secret Garden Marquee at Burwash Manor and feature dozens of suppliers over the 2 days. There will be tastings, samples, demos and exclusive offers.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
On the corner of Tennyson Road and Mill Road lies an unassuming little shop, but inside it is a treasure trove of spices, olive oils, chocolates, and anything a foodie heart could desire. Ruth asked owner Zoltan Bogati about his shop, Culinaris, and what they sell.
We sell here products from small producers. A lot of our fresh cheeses are coming from farms, whether it's from Switzerland, Britain, or Spain or Italy. The same for alcohol cuts and meats and hams. And what is common about them is that we have all tasted them. We go and source these directly and try to find new and interesting and good products all the time. We have about 1,500 products in our store currently. We have access to much more. This is actually a small store compared to our first stores or other stores we have in Hungary. And we try to show as much as possible here in Cambridge, and we hope to expand as well our range over the over this coming year.
So you started in Hungary. When did that start?
In 2003. Being a passionate self-taught amateur cook, I was trying to source products and ingredients for my cooking. This is why our company is called Culinaris Fine Food and Spices. Like spices was the first set. Even here in Cambridge, we have about 150 different fine and rare spices, only peppers, about 20, 30. And everything started from my passion for cooking. Over the years, we've been buying, interestingly, more and more British product. We started exporting from Britain, not only to Hungary, but other European countries. And actually, the Cambridge store grew out of our business, because at one point we thought, why not bring some of the products we in our stores in Budapest to Britain? And this is how it got started. We came across this fantastic location at the corner of Tennyson and Mill Road.
Tell us a bit about your favorite items in the shop.
Changes week by week, you know. Some week it's the pasta, the other week's the cheese or even the chocolate. Wow, I almost forgot about our bread. You know, it comes from our own bakery, and it's made with flour from Wessex. But if you ask me today what my favorite is probably this morning it would be cheese. I really love cheese. It's cheese from our friends in Switzerland, which I would mention. It's a small family business in the Emmental, just 30 minutes from Bern in the mountains, and it's one of the very few producers who make raw milk cheese in Switzerland. I like this morning, I would say cheese. You know, a cheese sandwich with our bread is something what I would grab right after this interview.
So you sell the sandwiches as well, and that's all done with your bread and your products, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and you know, freshly sliced ham and cheese in a sandwich. I think that's pretty much the best you can get.
Now you've got 1,500 items, and you taste all of them. How long does that take?
Well, I've started cooking at a very young age. My mother being a doctor, she was on night shifts quite a lot. You know, I've been tasting professionally products for probably 15 years. I'd like to try out new, but have gone through probably about 100,000 or even more products. I mean, we currently trade with more than 10,000 items, and I really taste everything, and I encourage our staff and all our staff, whether it's IT or just servicing, you know, are real foodies. You know, if you look at their Instagram pages, I mean, they're cooking the most amazing things. So we taste with our team almost everything. Not almost everything, but literally everything.
Do you go to the producers personally, or do you find them at fairs? How do you find these things?
Well, I'm always looking out for food. You know, wherever I go, wherever I travel, even if it's an airport shop or a market, or I just hear something, read something, I immediately go there. And well, if it's interesting enough, I'll go there and try it out. Past couple of weeks, I mean, it's slow, it's January, but I think I visited about a dozen producers and have been to something very exciting 2 weeks ago. It was a chocolate and cheese tasting, and it got me going, and I have some ideas working on that. We'll be participating at the Eat Cambridge in May. We'll have some fringe events, but we'll be exhibiting at the main event on May 7th, so that will be fun. We'll have a lot of products to taste, and you know, this is what we try to do, to bring people really closer to the source of food, show how varied it is, you know, how good trade is, and you know, good food makes people happy, and this is really what we want to do, and brings people together.
So you're doing fringe events for Eat Cambridge, but will you do anything in between now and then? That's not just the shop.
Well, we are just trying to get established, to get known, but we have always about a dozen products open in the store. You know, it's an ongoing tasting event every day. We try to figure out what people like, what local taste is. As I said, I don't have a constant favorite product. I'd like if our customers were appreciated the same way. Look out for the new things. Don't be afraid to ask. We have stories for literally every product, going down to the leaf or the milk or the grain, and we love to share those stories.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for sharing your story today, Zoltan.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Thank you.
I could be in there for hours. The staff are all incredibly passionate and knowledgeable about their products. Zoltan wasn't kidding. There's a story for everything in there. He told me quite a few. And that's no small feat for a store that has 1,500 products.
Now, Valentine's Day is next weekend, and we thought that we would ask Aoife Maxwell if she could design a cocktail for us.
I have to admit, I was a little dubious at first thinking about Valentine's. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not averse to a bit of theme cocktail action. I like a Christmas cocktail, you know, I like an Easter cocktail. But there's something about Valentine's in general that kind of turns me off a little bit. It feels a bit cheesy. But then I started thinking about it a little more, and I realised we've got a load of beautiful rhubarb around at the moment, coming into the markets. You see it everywhere, really, and I've always made rhubarb vodka, and I haven't made it in ages, and I thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity to go back and make one of my absolute favourite infused spirits. And I think we've talked about rhubarb vodka before, and I've got recipes how to make it on my blog, but it is very simple. You know, you just cut up some beautiful pink rhubarb into small pieces, toss it in a Kölner jar with a little bit of sugar. Some recipes you'll see use quite a lot of sugar. I just like to use enough to coat all the pieces, shake it up, and leave it to sit for 24 hours, and all this beautiful pink liquid starts to come out. And you could use that itself in cocktails directly. But then if you just top it up with vodka and leave it for a few days, you'll have beautiful rhubarb vodka. Mm. So this here, you can see it's a beautiful pink colour. Really delicate pink, though.
It's lovely. It's lovely, yeah.
It infused for about 5 days, so not very long. time. So still plenty of time to make some if you want to make some for Valentine's Day. If you want to try
them. Oh, I'd love some. I haven't had any rhubarb this year actually, so far. Oh, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
It's very rhubarb-y, isn't it? It is. It's not too sweet.
No, that is
rhubarb. It's not bad at all. That'll warm you up. Mm. So I make a very classic cocktail, a rhubarb sour with a herb-infused sugar syrup. That's on my blog as well. But I thought I would change it up a little bit and see what else we could combine with the rhubarb vodka. So I actually have some rose hip syrup left over from last autumn, which goes very nicely. And then I also found this beautiful rose liqueur in Cambridge Wine Merchants. And I really like the look of it. And it's a very similar pink, actually, to the rhubarb vodka. So the colours go really nicely together. So I'm going to use the rhubarb vodka, the rose liqueur. Not too much, because it's a little overpowering if you use too much. But just so there's a little background rose when you taste it.
Yeah.
And some rose hip syrup to give the sugar. And a little bit of lemon just to balance it out. Mm. And then I'm going to use two bitters. So our favourite rhubarb bitters, which I hope everyone has bought at this stage. And a bitters called Aphrodite bitters.
Oh, just how fitting.
Yes, absolutely. Just to add a little bitter touch, which the rhubarb bitters is really quite sweet tasting, I think, quite sherbety. Yeah. So just to give a little bitter. So, I mean, this is quite a difficult bitters to get, but you could use a drop of Angostura or something just to add that bitter fragrance. But I couldn't resist seeing as I have it, and the name goes perfectly for Valentine's. So it's quite a simple recipe. So we're going to take this is just to make one cocktail, 55 mils approximately of our rhubarb vodka, the pink colour. I'm going to take 20 mils of the rose liqueur, and then 20 mils of the rosehip syrup. I have a recipe for this as well. I mean, obviously, it'd be hard to get rosehips at this time, but you could just use a simple syrup, 1-to-1 sugar to water instead. I mean, it does give a nice little extra spicy, herby fragrance, but it's really for the sweetness. So 20 mils of that. And this, of course, is very good for you, packed full of vitamin C. So health drinks, as usual. And then just 20 mils or so of lemon, not too much. And then I can't resist my rhubarb bitters. It gives a lovely sherbety fragrance, just a few drops. And similarly with your bitter bitters, whether they're Aphrodite or Angostura, just a couple of drops. Okay, then I'm gonna pop in plenty of ice. And I'm going to give it a good stir.
Right. A very good stir.
Okay, we're ready to strain into our glass. I'm using quite a pretty cocktail glass shape. I got that in one of my favourite shops in the Dales Brewery building, the antique shops
yes,
there.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So I've just strained into the cocktail glass, beautiful pink colour. Now you could garnish this in two different ways. At the moment, Tiger are doing some fantastic, very cheesy cocktail accessories. So you could take I've got a pink heart-shaped cocktail stick, and I've just attached a few pieces of the rhubarb left over from the rhubarb vodka. So you could float that in, something like that. Or, much more classy, I have a dried rose petal.
Oh.
Just to float on it.
Oh, that does look nice.
Which looks a bit classier. So do you want to try that on?
I would love to try that.
Don't get too carried away with the romance.
Oh, that is divine. Do you know, I see what you mean about the sherbety. It comes through, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And there's a slight sourness there, and of course the taste of rhubarb.
And the rhubarb bitters always enhance that rhubarb flavour. That's why I love them. Mm. There's a good rhubarb hit. And just at the very back, I don't know if you can get it, I could when I made this previously, just that little hint of rose as it goes down. Mm. It's kind of a floral. You do have to be careful when I was first trying to put this together, overdid the rose a little bit. If you're a big fan of Turkish Delight, that's nice, but if you're not, it gets a bit too much. Yeah. So
that is a nice drink. Lovely. Could you just give us a quick resume?
Absolutely. So for this recipe, we used 55 mils of rhubarb vodka, 20 mils of rosehip syrup. You could substitute simple syrup. 20 mils of the rose liqueur, 20 mils of lemon juice, freshly squeezed, a few drops of rhubarb bitters, and a few drops of either Aphrodite or Angostura bitters. Stirred over ice and strained into a cocktail glass.
And enjoy.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Eva.
Well, that sounded really good, Alan.
Well, yes, it was. It was very good. And it looks good too. And if you go to Aoife's blog, sweetpeasandsours.com, you can see photos and Aoife's recipe as well.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Time now for our regular trip to Noel Young Wines in Trumpington, where Alan started by asking Dan Young about Dry January.
You know, I understand people's reasons for doing it, and I'm sure convince ourselves that we've been absolutely hammering it all of December, which probably isn't true, but we feel it's a good excuse to have a few extra days off, as we've just been talking to somebody else that we maybe should sort of try and do it in February, because it is at least a 4-week month and a bit shorter, so that makes it better for everyone.
What wines would entice people back, do you think? Have you got any?
Well, I think if you've had a whole month off, you probably want to take it steady on the first couple of bottles. 2014 Beaujolais, for example, are lovely. They're quite light, nice, juicy, very welcoming types of reds, if you like, and fairly easy on the palate. I think that might be a better start than perhaps a big sort of heavyweight Chateauneuf. Those would be great for reds. White, we've got been talking a lot about 2014 White Burgundy. We tasted quite a few of those back at the end of last year. And beautiful, and I really urge people who think and feel that they don't like Chardonnay to just have a little go at some of these. Some inexpensive Macon, for example, they are beautiful. They're fabulously balanced. They have plenty of fruit. They're still lovely and dry. They're not heavily oaked. They're not too rich. Lovely acidity. So that freshness, very drinkable. So you know, for the anything but Chardonnay crowd that still exists, I know who you are. I urge you to try this, because they're really, you know, Chardonnay has moved on tremendously from where people really went off it. And I think these White Burgundies, so you don't have to spend a lot.
What sort of price would you be talking
I think
about?
You know, 10 to 15, and they're great examples. I mean, you can spend a lot more, of course, but actually, you know, for something, you know, midweek or just, you know, casual drinking at the weekend.
Yeah. What about food matches?
Well, obviously you're going to go brilliantly with fish.
And fish is, of course, at its best.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Eating and drinking very, very well in conjunction. So there's a couple of schools of thought with how to match fish. If you have something oily like some salmon or some sea bass, then perhaps your inclination might be to have something a little bit crisper to contrast against that. I quite like this time of year to more go with the flow, and so have something a little bit more body. So again, one of these Macons work nicely. It's got a little bit more richness, still fresh, but it'll kind of go along with the flow of the flavour, and would complement very well. So,
I'm interested in the fact you mentioned 2014 and these good wines, these good Beaujolais and Chardonnays from 2014. Mm. 2014, I thought, had quite a lot of problems with the vintage. Has it turned out to be better than the press said?
In terms of Burgundy, then, which is where we are at the moment, we're very much in the middle of the on-primer swing, if you like, and there was a lot of press written. There always is. Not all of it's true, of course, but there was a particular infestation in a few vineyards around, particularly in places like Chambord, Mizigny, where there was a new strain, if you like, a fruit fly that came along and attacked just the Pinot Noir grapes, and had a tendency to make these grapes quite acidic, almost slightly vinegary, a character that you could definitely pick up if you walk through the vineyard, for example.
Well, you could smell it.
You could actually smell it, yeah. But any conscientious grower and winemaker is clearly going to sort through their grapes when they come in from harvest, and I would have expected that some 90% of those grapes that were properly affected would have been discarded. And actually, having tasted quite extensively last week and the week before in London. I think it's clear to say that fermentation has wiped out any other trace that there was of that characteristic. So the reds are, in general, very lovely, very pretty styles, as we'd call it, and they're going to drink very nicely quite early on, which is useful. We need a vintage like that. It may not be the most complex wines you're ever going to buy from Burgundy, but sometimes it's not always about just having complexity. It's sometimes about having the purity of the fruit, and that's why we chase Pinot Noir. And perhaps it's considered the holy grail of grapes, really, because when it's at its purest, it's perhaps one of the most enthralling grapes we have. I said they're not going to be wines to keep for 10, 20 years at all, much shorter term than that, but there are some definite bargains out there.
And are any drinking now, or is it too soon?
Probably just a little too soon. Some of these, well, in fact, the majority have probably only just started to be bottled properly, so they'll need 6 to 12 months to settle. But from a Bourgogne Côte de Nuit Village, for example, then I would think in the next 12 to 18 months they would be lovely. White-wise, is frankly a magnificent year for white Burgundy in general. Just again urge people that if you're used to buying a few reds to lay down and you don't really feel you've got any space, well, maybe just try getting a couple of whites in there, because they really are outstanding, and I think they would grace anyone's table.
And when would they be ready for drinking?
I think really and truthfully the end of this year onwards, for the, you know, if you were in the sort of the Meursault, Puy-Fuisset, Poligny sort of region, Chassagne, that, you know, these are reasonably expensive wines, so they will need a little bit of time to settle.
Dan, are there any sort of new countries, you know, entering the British market as far as wine is concerned? We've had a few from Eastern Europe, but anything else?
Yeah, I think emerging countries, you would look at South America, clearly not Chile and Argentina that have been with us for quite a while, but there's some been some very interesting wines tasted quite recently from Uruguay, some very good Brazilian, including some sparkling wine, which we tried quite recently. That was very, very good. It ties in quite nicely, I suppose, with the Olympics coming up later this year, but they are worth looking out for and not expensive. And probably another one would be South Africa. I think this year will be another very strong year for them. I think their whites in particular, extraordinary, some fantastic old vine, Chenin Blanc, Roussanne, Marsanne, Chardonnay, just really interesting field blends, if you like. So where the focus isn't really on actually what's in it, it's just the fact that these wines, they're from this vineyard, there probably are four or five great varieties in there, but hey, so what? The wine just tastes brilliant as it is. We don't really need to explore the ins and outs of it, which is quite an old-fashioned way of working.
Brilliant. So we'll perhaps be hearing more from you about them as the year progresses.
Fingers crossed if I have some.
Okay, thanks very much.
No problem, Alan.
Well, that sounds very encouraging. Excellent Beaujolais and white Burgundies. Now with some great reds on the way too. And thanks to Dan Young from Noel Young Wines in Trumpington.
And on to the food and drink news now, starting with the university. And Gigi Perry is here in the studio with a lot to tell us about.
Indeed. Tomorrow, the 7th of February, is the final Varsity Team selection for Cambridge University Blind Wine Tasting Society. The team representing Cambridge in the 2016 tasting season have already been selected. However, the final selection for the 6 team members to compete in Varsity, plus 1 reserve, will occur at this tasting. Those not aspiring for the team are still welcome to join to practice under exam conditions and have the opportunity to see how you might score compared to others. More details can be found on their website, and that's true of all the news items today. Cambridge University Wine Society has 3 events coming up in the next fortnight. Their first is an evening of South African wines with Darren Broden of Vintjesiewe. Vintjesiewe imports boutique, handcrafted wines from the vineyards of Amar, J.P. Bridell, Molyneux, Newton Johnson, Rousseau and Uvemura. Uvemura is currently producing one of the world's best Chardonnays, so you can be assured of quality wines. That takes place on Tuesday the 9th of February in the Wordsworth Room at St John's College. And for a fun Valentine's treat, try spending your evening with Cambridge University Blind Wine Tasting Society for a night of their classics versus trendy with Anthony Robel. We have heard of the classics, tried and tested styles like those emerging from Burgundy, Left Bank Bordeaux and the Rhone Valley. These are Antony's bread and butter. However, blind tasters are challenged by an ever-changing wine scene and the rise to prominence of recently hard-to-find grape varieties in the UK market. This tasting will provide a backbone of classics reference but provide exposure to some varieties doing the rounds in London wine bars right now. And on Tuesday the 16th February, Cambridge University Wine Society is holding an evening with Mauro Manzoni of Giovanni Manzoni, a producer of exceptionally high quality Barolos. Their vineyard is located in Montfort d'Alba, Piedmont, and the entire production is focused on high quality wine and limited to about 50,000 bottles a year. The vineyard fosters naturally low-yielding vines, which produce wines that are approachable while young, yet remain amongst the most concentrated and longest-lived of all Barolos. It takes place in Upper Hall, Peterhouse. Tickets are on sale soon from the Society's website, so snap yours up before they go. And on Thursday the 18th of February, Sylvie Caz is holding a tasting evening with wine from her recently acquired vineyard, Château Chauvin, located in the northwest of Saint-Emilion. Sylvie has had an illustrious career in wine, so she's highly knowledgeable, and it really promises to be such an informative, delicious and very lively evening. You can buy your tickets online. And finally, on Friday the 19th of February, Cambridge University Whisky Appreciation Society are hosting their Whisky Showdown, domestic versus international. Following on from the great success that was last year's event, you can expect a great variety of whiskies and plenty of lively debate. A fortnight full of alcohol-based events, but all promised to be great fun, delicious and just full of new knowledge.
Great stuff. Thanks very much, Gigi. And on to the city news now, Ruth.
Jalan Jalan will be popping up at Novi in Regent Street on the 10th and 24th of February and at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street on the 20th of February from 12 till 3 and 6 till 9. Also at Calverley's, but on the 13th of February, is Holy Schnitzels, and that's from 6 till 9pm.
Fitzbillies will be open on Valentine's Day for evening meals. You can book via their website.
And there's loads happening at Novi in Regent Street. Paella Cucina, or Paella Cucina, will be there on Wednesdays throughout February. Reggae Kitchen on Thursdays, Gorilla Kitchen on Fridays, and Steak and Honour on Saturdays, all serving from 5.30 till 9. And the Allotment Cafe will be there from Thursday to Saturdays from 9am to 3pm.
Querico Tapas will be at the Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road. That's on the 19th and the 26th of February and the 4th of March.
On the 20th of February, there will be a Love Food Fair at the Central Library from 10.30 till 3pm. It's a free event and there are talks on Love Food Hate Waste, All About Tea, The Food Bank, Honey and Beekeeping and Food Cycle.
There are some good food-related events at the Cambridge History Festival too. On the 25th of February, Fenland Feasts and Fasts, a talk by Dr. Annie Gray. The 26th of February, Beer and Brewing in Cambridge with Camera. And the 26th of February again, but at lunchtime, tour of the old Cambridge pubs. 5th of March, historic dining at Clare College with guest speaker Tim Hayward. All these need to be booked, and some events are selling out fast.
And finally, MasterChef finalist and proprietor of The Hole in the Wall, together with Ian Cumming, recent Bake Off finalist, will be holding a cooking demonstration at Edenstone's in Bottisham on the 27th of February. More info is available at edenstone.co.uk, and there will also be children's workshops.
And that's all we have time for today. Why not enjoy Second Helpings tomorrow at 7am on Cambridge 105, and we're also podcast from early next week. Remember, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.fm or follow us on Twitter @flavour105.
And coming up next is Mandy's Garden Shed, the programme hosted by Mandy Morton. You can join her and Nicola on a winter walk at Anglesey Abbey as they enjoy the famous snowdrops and catch up with their allotment as they prepare for spring planting in the rain and the wind. And where have the onions gone?
Then, three eclectic light show specials. 2pm, Kate Bush. 3, Agatha Christie. 4, John Lennon. And at 5pm, Radio Dante. And then at 6pm, Trevor Dan with the Cambridge Minds. We're back on the 20th of February, and until then,
bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.